Okay, people, I think we can start now. So, welcome to these very final lectures of the Principles of Banking course for this year. We have the honor to have Olli-Pekka Ruuskanen here as the final guest
Hi.
lecturer, and he will be giving this presentation from Helsinki. He's also working as the as a adjunct professor at the University of Vaasa, but I let him introduce him himself in the beginning. So, he will be talking about things that are actually to a degree already covered in various parts of the course, but he gives us beautifully nice views that are a bit different compared to that we have been discussing here in the previous sections of the course. So remember that these lectures are also an essential part of the exam requirements. Okay. Please, stage is yours, Olli-Pekka, and welcome.
Okay. Thank you very much, Juha-Pekka, for I inviting me, and hello, everybody. I'm really happy to be able to share two lectures with you on this very interesting topic. I'm going to cover a kind of a new emerging areas in a financial sector and how they come about. And that's why the lectures are actually about financial innovation at large, about fintech, which is kind of like the companies that are born out of this kind of financial innovation. And then we are going to talk a little bit about shadow banking, which is kind of like credit intermediation and lending that is not through the official kind of regulated channels in the financial sector. So these are actually quite large areas, and they kind of go over the kind of banking theory. But I think that these are kind of the new emerging trends, and it would be very beneficial for you to get the kind of like understanding of how in research and in actual practice these things are kind of tackled at the moment. But in order to do so, I think that it is important to kind of have a clear picture of why kind of banks exist, and why are there kind of financial intermediation, and what are kind of like the root causes for such a phenomena. Because if we don't understand those characteristics, then it's going to be difficult for us to understand why are there actually innovation, why are there these new kind of emerging entities coming up as a kind of like supplementary or even kind of challenging things to the present state of the financial markets. So that's a pretty much what I'm going to talk about in these kind of 45 minutes sessions. And maybe I kind of first tell a little bit about who am I and what is kind of my background to tell you about these things. And as Juha-Pekka mentioned, I'm currently the adjunct professor in banking and insurance in the University of Vaasa, but my daily bread comes from Pellervo Economic Research. I'm there the research director, and I head the National Economics department here. And this is one of the kind of four major economic research institutes in Finland. You might know ETLA. You might know Palkansaajien tutkimuslaitos, which is like the labor institute, and then there's of course the government one, which is VATT. And we are kind of connected with mutual insurance companies, with cooperative banks, and also kind of agricultural and forest sector. So that's kind of our background, and I have been working in both in academic world, but also in kind of applied side, in the sense that I have had an opportunity to, for example, to be in Uganda in East Africa and head the kind of trade association for insurance companies for a number of years there in early 2000. And I have been also kind of like involved with the insurance companies trade association in Finland, which I was the the head of research there. So, you know, I have had opportunity to see things in various sites, and I hope I can kind of deliver these kind of different viewpoints to you during these lectures, so that it's not only kind of academic kind of research led discussion, but there is also kind of views from the kind of like the real world, in the sense that what is happening at the moment. So this is kind of like where I think I would kind of, you know, start. And I understood from Juha-Pekka that you have actually a number of textbooks and that has been assigned. And I have actually also based my lectures on three, which are of a various difficulty. The first one is kind of the basic text. I understood that is required. In this course, it's Economics of Money, Banking and Financial Markets. It's this Frederick Mishkin's kind of like Bible of the area. But then I would actually recommend two other books. This Kent and Thompson's The Economics of Banking, which is, they are two UK professors, I have found kind of useful as a kind of intermediate text, in a sense that it has a little bit more math, but it's not as demanding as the third one, which is this Fraixas and Rochette's Microeconomics of Banking. And if you have taken a quick look at it, it's kind of challenging. So these are the three different levels out of which you can kind of find the one that you find easiest to kind of dwell into and maybe, you know, to look things further. So these are the books and basically what I'm thinking of doing is that as I mentioned, I'm going to take a kind of a very kind of a basic view of the role of financial markets, and then to go to these, you know, fundamental questions. Why are there kind of financial intermediation? Why are there banks? What are kind of like the behavioral features in human being that actually give rise to this kind of like organizations? Because they try to address in many cases shortcomings that people have, or the distrust that is existent within the kind of interaction of economic entities. So that kind of takes this first two 45 minute section. So I hope we can get into the financial innovation in the end of this first two 45-minute sessions, and then we're going to break, and then we're going to go deeper into the financial innovation and fintech and shadow banking. But I think that this will give you a kind of a more ground to understand these things. But before I kind of now start with the full speed, I just want to check that is my voice audible? Can you hear me? And then the second is that, am I speaking in a kind of too fast or too slow, or is my kind of speaking understandable? So if
at least from my point of view, everything is just beautiful.
Okay, so then I'm gonna take my small jacket off and start working.
Does anyone else have any problems?
No, all good here.
Yeah. Good. Excellent. Okay, so let's start from the beginning. So why do we have financial systems? Why does there exist such a thing in an economy? And this is a very very old old kind of emphasis on different features by Merton, one of the kind of fathers of the financial markets theory, and basically, you know, the functions that are delivered is that you have to have some kind of like mechanism to move funds across kind of time and space. You also need to have some kind of features that make it possible to pool funds together. Very important is the ability to manage risk. We go deeper into this in the upcoming lectures, but these are kind of like the general kind of headlines that has to do with what is the functions. Then there is very important need to extract information, and financial markets do that very well. As you know, there is like almost real time pricing happening in the markets. Lots of information about the value and the quantities offered, and everything is produced for market participants to evaluate. And then very importantly is also that these financial systems address the problems of moral hazard and asymmetric information. And just to kind of recap, moral hazard actually means that you can't perceive a behavior of a person, and because you don't see that behavior, then the person has an incentive to act in kind of not as has been agreed. And of course, the asymmetric information, which then gives a kind of like also the thing that all people don't have the same information, and they have to kind of make decisions based on a kind of various levels of information. And then of course the facilitating sale through payment system, and this is a very important and actually almost a kind of the crowning feature if we look at the economic history, that you kind of like make the barter and trade of goods possible. What does a kind of like economic theory in its purest form say about banking and these financial intermediaries? Let's go to the really to the basic root of economic theory, which is the competitive equilibrium that is kind of like produced in a competitive economy that is characterized by full information, and this kind of world is called Arrow-Debreu world, and basically that is the world where kind of these fundamental results of economics have been produced, that there is a competitive equilibrium and it's kind of like stable, and that is the economy will kind of converge to one and everything. So if we look, banks in that kind of world, we can kind of model it, and just sorry about technicalities here. This is not the kind of like something that you can clearly kind of like look, I have just taken a few items here, but let's just assume that there is like two time periods, and we make a lot of like kind of simplifying assumptions, and there's this kind of one physical good and consumption is divided between these two periods, and there's like one consumer that is also stockholder, and then there's a firm, and there's then this bank. Now let's assume more that there's like two assets. There are like these kind of deposits, and then there is loans and securities, which are perfect substitutes. So deposited loans and securities are the two assets. And as you know, in this kind of environment, you know, everybody maximizes their utility or profits, and the consumer then maximizes his consumption, and he has to kind of divide her or his savings between these bank deposits and securities. And then, you know, firm chooses investments and financing through loans or securities. So there is this consumer's kind of time allocation problem, and also the problem of dividing between whether to kind of put the money on the bank or give them to the firm as a securities. And the firm has the similar problem of looking at whether to loan it from the public or kind of like from the bank. To issue securities or loan it from the bank. And then there is this bank that tries to maximize the profits and, you know, by supplying loans and then, you know, kind of giving, taking deposits from the consumers, and the bank also issues bonds. Well, in this kind of world, in the equilibrium, when everybody behaves optimally, the results are that all these rates on the loans, rates that the depositors get, and the bonds, they all are equal, and banks make no profit whatsoever. So actually, banks are redundant. There is like no effect on it. You could do without them. I just give you the schema here. The whole thing is, if you want to look at it a bit more, and also the math involved and everything, you can find that that discussion in this Freixas and Rochette's book. This is not a surprising kind of result. It's basically this: if you have read corporate finance, it's this Modigliani-Miller theorem just applied for banking. As you know, the Modigliani-Miller theorem says that the debt-like equity ratio is irrelevant. And this is kind of like the similar results for banking. So what is interesting is that this result actually is kind of robust when there is uncertainty, as long as there is like complete financial markets. So it's kind of like surprising that if you have a theory that is kind of very accepted, kind of like almost universally, and you get the result that a phenomenon that you can clearly see in the real world doesn't exist or does have no kind of justification in this kind of model, then you kind of think that what's happening? Is there something wrong with the theory, or is there something wrong with your eyes? Why are there these banks and other financial intermediaries? So the next step, of course, with this kind of results is that you have to somehow justify what would be the reason for these kind of entities to exist, these kind of organizations to be there in the real world. So there's these two ways out of this problem that has been suggested, and the two ones are actually the incomplete markets paradigm, and then there is the other one, which is this industrial organization view. And let's stop here for a moment. So this incomplete markets paradigm says that, the assumption here was that the markets are complete, which means that for all contingencies, you can make actually a contract that is enforceable. But that isn't the case. There's a lot of like things that you cannot kind of contract on, and there's a lot of information differences between the market players, and therefore there is like need for these kind of banks to exist. So they will kind of like correct the market in a sense that they will provide this information and they can kind of foster these kind of exchanges that are lacking because of these incomplete markets. And then there is this kind of industrial organization view, which says that actually, you know, banks create value. They create value by offering services to customers. So the customers are willing to pay for these, and therefore, you know, there has to be a product differentiation. We have to depart from this kind of like pure competitive equilibrium model to more kind of like industrial organization, monopolistic, monopoly type of market environments. So, what are then these functions? We started from the beginning. Here is a little bit more kind of towards the kind of resolution of the problems that why are there need for these? And as you can see, there can be a departures from this ROW world then can be like economies of scale. There is all kinds of different type of things that depart them. But the most important thing for if we look at this incomplete markets paradigm would be that it kind of these banks are able to take care of the asymmetric information problems. And here is actually a good kind of summary taken from Mishkin about what are these kind of asymmetric information problems and how actually these kind of financial intermediaries can try to solve them. And I just checked from Juha-Pekka that everybody, I quickly told about the moral hazard and I didn't mention the adverse effects, but is this kind of like basic grain in a sense that I don't need to go into this in detail?
Well, we have been discussing about this already in the lectures, but you can recap, you can take a recap of this.
Okay.
It's good.
Yes. Thanks. Well, adverse selection is actually a very interesting phenomenon. And if I can go to kind of like insurance as to kind of highlight this, because I think the adverse selection is very easily understood on that context. The adverse selection means that if you don't know the characteristics of the population that you are trying to kind of sell your product and that price that you have to charge for that product or service has to do with the characteristics of that population, then you are in trouble. And how does this come about, for example, in insurance? Let's say that there is a pool of insurance customers that want to have a car insurance. But you don't know actually, you know, which ones are high-risk customers and which ones are low-risk customers. Then in that case, you have to put that car insurance pricing on the average average cost of the possible kind of accidents that's going to happen. So then you have to price both for low risk and high risk on the kind of average risk level. What does this mean to the customers? It means that those that have low risk have the expected value of that premium, that average premium, less than what their kind of advantage, utility coming out of their behavior is, because they are low risk, they don't get into the accident. So that costs, that average price is too high for them. They don't buy this insurance. Then these high risk customers think that, hey, well, this is average price, our kind of expected loss from all these accidents is much higher than this premium, average premium. So we all take it. So all the high risk people will take the insurance and all the low risks won't buy the insurance. So actually the insurance company makes a loss. And if it tries to cover it, it has to then, there is only these high risks, but even in this high risk case, there is low risks, low high risks and high risks. And again, you have to do it in the average, so you miss half of the market. So this adverse selection means that actually the market, because you don't know the characteristics of your customers, will actually disappear. It's also called like market for lemons, which is the original article. This was in 1970. This was kind of like, you know, published this first results. But this is a problem in banking also, and the tools to solve it is that actually you try to get as much information about your customers as possible, and you can do it privately. You can make government to regulate and order the production of more information. And then there is kind of like possibilities to kind of demand collateral if you loan for somebody, and then the financial intermediation as a kind of the tool itself. The moral hazard in is another thing, and as I said, this means that you cannot kind of observe the subsequent behavior of a person you kind of like have a relationship with, and this would mean that you kind of in an insurance context you insure a person and he says I'm a very good driver, and as soon as he gets the insurance he starts driving recklessly, so then you kind of have a moral hazard. In banking those can be in both in you know equity contracts which is then a kind of like the principal agent problem, which means that you have a you kind of have an equity and you know how much that equity actually kind of how profitable the equity shares are is based on how well the kind of firm is managed, and you don't have a kind of possibility to then to kind of look at it. And in the debt contracts, it means that, you know, there's the possibility of default that, you know, you loan to somebody and he doesn't pay back. So the then these kind of solutions for these are that you kind of, again, you have the you know, the production of information, either privately or regulated by government, or then you have a different kind of covenants, collaterals, net worth, and again, like financial intermediation. So these are kind of like the problems. And when we go actually to financial innovation, when we go to fintech and shadow banking, it's kind of funny that although these are one of the major constituencies, like the reasons for this kind of financial intermediation organizations to exist, there's very little talk or thinking about what is kind of like the implications of adverse selection and moral hazard to kind of fintech firms or shadow banks and such. So most of the kind of mainstream banking theory has to do at least partly of tackling these problems. But when we go to this kind of like open new fields, these things have not been talked as much as I think should have been talked, because these same problems are, of course, prevalent in these new areas also. Let's go back a little bit again, why there would be such things as a banks. There are these kind of like these asymmetric information problems, but there is also a different kind of features that has been proposed very early on to kind of justification for this type of things. And if you look at the kind of depositors, if you are a person that has money and you have a kind of, you face this kind of requirement to have money across your kind of lifetime, but then you don't know actually when a liquidity shock, like for example unemployment or something, happens to you. So you have these assets, but you really don't know when do you need to get access of them, and do you have then enough of them? And this is something that you cannot kind of observe. You don't know when the kind of, for example, unemployment hits you, so you cannot have any kind of securities that you can't write contracts on them. So then you could have a kind of for example, let's call it the bank, that would kind of collect all these individuals' money together. There would be a coalition of depositors, and if these kind of liquidity shocks, if somebody gets unemployed this year and the other person gets next year and one doesn't get at all. And so then if these so-called shocks are not perfectly correlated, then the reserves needed to kind of take care of these shocks increases less than proportionally. So you don't need to have the money at hand all the time, because you can deposit them to a bank, and then, you know, the bank kind of manages these intertemporal shocks for you. So that's kind of like the idea why you would have an incentive to take your money to the bank as a kind of deposit. What about borrowers? You need some funds you don't have. You have a kind of investment or business plan that has a kind of positive expectations of profit, but you know, you can't get a loan. You also don't, you have the information about the quality, how good this project is, how much money you are going to make, but you can't kind of like, again, you know, make contracts on that. So you have to somehow single the quality of those projects. And one of the way of signaling is that the borrower says that, okay, I will put my own money in it there also. So that's kind of like will show that I really think that this is a good kind of investment or transaction, and therefore, you know, you should also kind of have then the assurance that I'm a good credit quality, and you can borrow to me money. And this can also be done kind of like in banks, in a sense that if these borrowers come together and they form partnerships, banks, then they get kind of better financing conditions. And for the lenders now in this kind of situation, it's actually costly to monitor, because if you loan somebody money and you have this, first of all, this moral hazard, they can, you know, behave unlike you agreed in the first place. And then you really don't know the quality of the project, only the borrower knows it, then you kind of like have to monitor, and this is costly. And therefore, it's good to kind of like to have a bank to do it, that can kind of like monitor and manage these loans. So there is like the bank kind of offers solutions to the depositors, and then, you know, the borrowers, and in sometimes the, of course, the lenders are also the depositors, but they can be other entities. So then this can be one of all these different stakeholders benefit for the existence. But if this is the case, and as you can see from the last, actually the delegated monitoring actually implicates that the most kind of cost efficient way would be to have just the one monopoly bank in the world, which would do this monitoring if there is like increasing returns to scale But the reality, once again, in the real world, is that there is banks and there is also other financial intermediaries. So what could be kind of like the reason for this? And there is like a number of justifications for this. And actually, what this kind of line of theorizing says is that if you are a big company, for example, and you have a very good credit worthiness and you have a kind of like a lot of collateral and very good credit ratings and everything, then you actually don't use banks. You go directly to the financial markets and you kind of issue the securities and debt and you collect them. And only those households and small firms that have not these abilities will then kind of revert to bank lending. So there is like the best quality players are there directly, and then the, you know, the not so well or small or opaque players have to resort to banks. This is one of the kind of like reason why there would exist both. Well, what would be the optimal size of financial sector if these are the needs, if this is kind of like the way that the banking and financial sector is generated, and how if you look at the kind of needs of the firms and households and individuals, what is the optimal size of financial sector? And there has been a number of studies trying to kind of look what in a kind of full functioning economy the size of this sector should be. And it's very interesting that these are kind of aged in the sense that these are from the early 2010. Actually, this lot of this discussion came about after subprime crisis, the financial crisis of 2008, which had led to a quite a big financial sector in the, for example, in the United States. And it's about said that, you know, the it should be about the optimal amount of debt in the economy should be about 85-90, and there should be about kind of like 4% of the total employment should be connected with financial sector. However, this is the what we observe in the world is much higher. There is then discussion, is the kind of financial sector too big? Is there kind of like is the kind of financial sector taking over the real sector? And is there kind of like reasons or phenomena or incentives that make it kind of like bigger than it should be? This is a discussion that actually the regulators dwell quite a lot, especially they did after the financial crisis. At the moment with the COVID, this is not obviously a kind of like a big discussion item, but it will come about. So this was actually the kind of like the background for existing of financial markets and banks. Do you have some questions at the moment? I can't see your raised hands, and Juha-Pekka said that he will actually be in charge of these questions. So has this kind of raised any issues for you at the moment?
There are no questions in the chat room or anywhere else, so I think you can continue.
Yeah, do you have something to add or do you have something to correct or?
No, I think that this fits quite beautifully to all the discussions that we have had earlier. So just continue.
Okay, so now I'm going to go a little bit more on the banks as such. Now we had the kind of a more kind of like wider scope in the financial sector, but now we go to the banking, and I think something that is good to keep in mind is that there's kind of like I think nice definition of a bank, because if we think that what the bank actually is, one usually thinks it other way around than this Fraixas and Rochette's definition. And here, the bank, by them, the bank is defined as a financial intermediary that buys loans and sells deposits. And I think this is kind of like a very nice way and kind of counterintuitive at first. But so the bank actually buys loans from companies, because they get this, you know, they give money to the companies and they get these kind of debt notes. And then they sell kind of deposit or bank deposits to the customers, and they get money as a deposit. So So this is kind of like the bank's business model. And I think it's kind of like nicely captures what they are doing. So they are selling deposits and buying securities from the markets by issuing loans. Of course, there is this transformation function that is happening concurrently. There is this size transformation, which means that a lot of these deposits are very small, and they have to be kind of like raised at the very short notice, and then the loans that the banks give to the companies then are usually very large. So in the banking, you have the depositor small deposits transferred to a large loans. It's also the maturity transfer. These you have, of course, these are the from the first lecture, I guess. And then there's this maturity transformation, which I also said that, you know, usually the small depositors want to have access to their funds almost immediately. And then these loans that you give to companies can run tens of years. So there is this maturity transformation. And then there's, of course, this risk transformation also that by kind of like pooling the funds and giving them to different entities as loans, then there is this risk transformation where some types of risks, liquidity risk, refinancing risk, and everything are kind of like also become about and also are kind of changed in their nature. In order to understand this role of a bank and the transformation it does, and to kind of bring it back to this financial innovation and fintech and shadow banking, it's good to kind of go a little bit on the kind of industrial organization and competition side of a banking theory. Because usually the basic credo of economics is that competition is always good. But there's a lot of literature in banking which kind of indicates that actually competition is not that beneficial in banking, at least to the kind of theorist level. And the reason for this is these specific characteristics we visited earlier. I also want to kind of highlight that the same kind of problematic relationship to the extent of competition also is manifested, for example, in insurance, because you don't want to have a kind of like a too kind of aggressive pricing, for example, of insurance products. So both of these kind of banking and insurance and finance, that's there is like a discussion whether the competition actually enhances or can it be detrimental to the sector. So it really has an impact because, of course, if there is a competition, then, you know, your profitability and your kind of size and is affected within the kind of industry. But as a banking fulfills a very important kind of function in the economy. If something goes wrong, then it can have a kind of macroeconomic effects. And there is a number of studies looking at does this kind of increased competition promote stability? And here the idea is that if these kind of levels of risks are very hard to monitor, then the banks have incentives to kind of maximize risk taking. And because of the very important function that the banking sector banks in the economy fulfill. And there has been these bank crises in many jurisdictions. Almost all there is at least some kind of deposit insurance, which means that if the bank becomes insolvent, then the government will actually compensate for the depositors for losing their money. And this deposit insurance actually can be thought of as a put option, which means that then you kind of like maximize the value of a bank by maximizing the risk. And if, you know, if the risks turn out to cause insolvency in a bad case, then, you know, the government takes care of it. So this type of situation where the deposits are actually guaranteed by the government and there is kind of like this attempt to maximize profits, it will mean that the banking sector actually maximizes the risk. And this has a bad effects on consumer welfare, of course, because you take too much risk. Well, how do you kind of tame this? How do you kind of like incentivize the managers of a banks not to take too much risks? And one of the proposed solutions is that there should be something that that is kind of up for loss if the bank goes bankrupt. And one of the proposals has been this kind of like charter value of a bank. And this could be meant as a, perhaps an equity value, but it's kind of like the discounted value of the future profits that the bank would make. Well, there is the arrow depro perfect competition result again, that if in that kind of situation you saw banks make no profit, so then the charter value actually is zero. So there's no incentives in that kind of situation for the bank managers to kind of tame their risk taking. One solution for kind of generating these character values is to let banks to kind of make profit, because then these profits and the expectancy of the future profits would then incentivize the bank managers. So then there could be a kind of like the government imposed regulation, or then there could be a barriers to entry, or such other things that actually depart the banking sector from the perfect competition case and give a rise to a charter value. Then another possibility is that you have perfect information. And if you have a charter value, which is positive, and you have a perfect information, then the bank actually, it can be shown that the bank has a kind of like the incentives go around. Actually, you try to kind of choose a minimal level of risk to kind of like to keep the bank afloat. However, if there's imperfect information, then, you know, it's back to this maximum level of riskiness again. So how does this show in the real world? Well, there is an extensive amount of disclosure that is required by regulators, which is actually, you know, trying to kind of generate this information. And then, of course, there is the possibility, and which is actually the case, that there is this capital requirements. You need to kind of have minimum capital in the banks. Nowadays, it's tied to the risks you are taking. It's risk-based, and this kind of like implies this charter value. And then, you know, there is another thing that can also decrease this risk-taking, and it's this kind of relationship banking. And relationship banking means that you have a long relationship with your customers. And we'll go next to it. Not yet, but I'm going to talk a little bit about relationship banking. Because why relationship banking is interesting in this kind of fintech and financial innovation is that actually a lot of these new innovations have to do with kind of digitalizing and quantifying the banking relationship between the bank and the customer, and that actually takes the dent out of this relationship banking a lot. And there's a lot of discussion whether this has kind of enhanced or is it determinal, this finance innovation in that respect. But still, there is this monitoring and screening we talked about earlier. And here is a certain amount of models, which I won't go deeper, but there is, depending on the level of kind of information and the structure of a bank, there is a different kind of optimal amounts of monitoring and screening. And it also kind of has to do with who gets loans and who doesn't. But I don't go into that. I go to this relationship banking. And this relationship banking has the idea that as it is costly for the bank to get to know the customer, as you know, there was this kind of like inability of kind of really verifying the kind of the profitability of the certain projects that the borrower or the firm or the customer has, and it takes time to kind of assess the quality of the customer. Then it is beneficial for these banks to deal repeatedly with the same customer, because as you deal repeatedly, then the information about the quality of the customer gets enhanced. And it also then makes it actually in the long run a bit cheaper to offer for these customers the same products, because then the level of risk goes down as you know the customer better. So then when the bank has a kind of like a long-term relationship, the customer benefits from lower fees, but also the bank has a kind of better quality and then has a kind of pricing power towards the customer. The problem here is that in this kind of setting, there is a lock-in effect, which means that there is like a hold-up where actually the bank can start taking advantage of this relationship in a sense that it doesn't pass all the surplus that is generated from this kind of relationship to the customer, but keeps it to themselves. And as they get more profits out of these customers that they have relationship with, then this actually makes them profit. And this is this charter value which it runs into this charter value. And then this kind of relationship banking is beneficial. And as you know, a lot of the banking relationships are long-term. As I mentioned, this is one of the areas that is kind of under threat from these new innovations. They are trying to kind of like to move into this relationship banking in a sense that the new entities are trying to kind of offer a lot of this information that is usually connected with relationship banking as a kind of digital means to make a more better credit assessments without kind of having a long-term relationship with the customer. I want to highlight here, just to kind of go a little bit into the second part of the lecture, is it's interesting to notice that, for example, in Finland, there has been a long-term opposition by banks to credit bureaus and positive credit registers. Which means that, the positive credit register actually means that you can take a customer's, you can kind of check how much loans, for example, a given customer has. Or what is kind of the credit bureau is the like, kind of like, what is the kind of quality of the customer. So not until now, when there has been a lot of these payday pikavippi and all this kind of new emerging kind of competitors to the banks. Now they are kind of like more positively inclined for this type of registers. But the reason for bank banks being opposed to this kind of open information about or easily accessed verified information about their customers probably is because of this relationship banking. So they don't want the other banks to come and steal their customers because they have had a lot of, you know, kind of like costs involved to kind of assessing which ones are good and which ones are bad. But the relationship banking is highlighted in the literature as a kind of like one of the reasons there. Well, if we look at the value chain in banking, we go a little bit out of this pure economics and we go more like kind of business economic side. There are these kind of like fundamental building blocks over banks, which of course has to do with this product development, what type of products they offer, how they market them, how they manage these credits, how they the credit that they kind of give, how they manage their assets and how they run their kind of treasury. And then there's of course this advisory services, and then there is the background kind of like functions like infrastructure and personal ICT and procurement. And when we go back more kind of in depth into this financial innovation and fintech, then we can see from here which kind of areas these new entities actually target and where have they tried to kind of find a niche to kind of challenge the banking sector. That's about the kind of banks and why they exist and why there is like this competition is not beneficial as such, you know, and there's a lot of discussion about the stability and the competition and things like that. Before we go to shadow banks, I actually moved it here because I think that this is kind of like the next kind of like area we could look at. Is there any questions about or comments or views or something about the banks as such? What about you, Pekka?
Well, there is still nothing in the chat room, so I think you can continue again.
Okay, thanks. So now we saw that, you know, these have been theoretically given reasons for existing of banks. And now we could kind of like talk a little bit about shadow banks. And this is a kind of a term that is not very old. To my understanding, it was kind of coined around 2005. I think first kind of academic paper mentioning this is kind of like end of you know, close to 2010. But we can see that this kind of shadow banks have become more prominent, and therefore it's good to kind of a little bit talk about them as it seems that their share of the financial sector is growing quite rapidly, and these shadow banks are actually growing also, especially in the kind of emergent markets. So therefore, it's good to kind of talk about them. And there is two kind of definitions for shadow banks. The first one is the Financial Stability Board's definition from 2011. And they define shadow banks as this kind of credit intermediation involving entities and activities outside the regular banking system. So you look at the kind of regular banking system that is kind of like, you know, has been like there. And then if there is a credit intermediation from the entities that are not kind of usually put under the banking system, then that's kind of like, then that would be a shadow banks. But it's kind of like vague definition. And the other one is POTS. Actually, it's not POTSAR, it's POTSNAR. So I'm sorry, S would be N. And he gave a definition that this shadow bank actually has to do with this kind of liabilities that are financial in nature, but that they are not guaranteed by the official sector. So they are kind of like, they are financial liabilities that if something goes wrong, are lost. So those are the kind of two major definitions that has been proposed to kind of look at the shadow banks. And then we have to go back to this banking theory and ask, why does these shadow banks exist? Why are there this kind of, why hasn't all this financial intermediation kind of like done through the banks? Why are there other entities that have been popping up to do this thing? And one of the reasons is that actually there is a kind of innovations in composition of money. What does this mean? It means that there is kind of a new type of money lending and transactions and liquidity management that has to do with this kind of financial innovations. It has to do with the kind of like digital money, like, you know, the platforms, the kind of decomposition of risk from the kind of underlying securities, about the payment system, everything. So these are the stuff that, you know, the shadow banks have been created for. And the other one is this regulatory arbitrage. So in all the cases where there is kind of regulation, then this regulation usually have costs, financial costs, and also kind of costs that involve of like forbidding certain activities and therefore not being able to conduct them and make profit out of them. So the shadow banks partly are answer for this, that there is incentives to take financial intermediation out of the kind of regulatory oversight in order to cut costs, in order to kind of, avoid tax payments. And there's also this kind of like, in many cases, attempt to kind of use this kind of illegal, to kind of wash money, launder money, stuff like that. So those are also not to be taken lightly, one of the reasons why these kind of entities exist. So what are the kind of features of these kind of shadow banks? And they have a number of kind of like things that a little bit differentiate them from the... before I go, I have these now in the wrong order. Let's go first, because now I haven't given you any examples of shadow banks. So wait a minute, how did this come about? Wait a minute. Okay, like that. So let's look what we are talking about. I'm sorry, maybe I should have started with this one. So what are these shadow banks? What is these kind of things that are kind of like outside normal banking sector and that are usually not guaranteed by the government? And you can see here that there's these hedge funds. That's a kind of especially in the United States, a huge area. Then there's all kinds of finance companies. And these finance companies here means also this kind of like payday lenders, so pikavippi, this kind of like, consumer, a durable goods company, financing companies. Then there is all kinds of special purpose vehicles that usually has to do with the mortgage lending and transformation of mortgages. They have to do also with securitization of different assets and selling them. There is money market funds, which are really prevalent, for example, in China, where there is still a kind of like there has been for a long time a cap on interest rates paid on deposits. So people have incentive to put their money on these money market funds that actually give them a bigger return on their kind of deposits that they kind of like put on these funds. And the problem there is, of course, that these are not guaranteed by no kind of deposit insurance or everything. Then there's this big area of private equity that actually is the money that has been put also, of course, into these fintech firms and all the other startups. And then there is this crowdfunding platforms, which is maybe a little bit kind of a smaller area, but has taken now a number of hits because of, you know, the problems of non-payment and default and like that. So many of these have actually Prosper and such in United States have serious problems at the moment. But these are kind of like examples of these kind of shadow banking entities. So they are not banks, as you can see. They are like, they call shadow banks, but they are like hedge funds, finance companies, special purpose vehicles, money market funds, private equity. So what is kind of like, I go back, what are the features here? So usually what these type of entities have, they transform risk characteristics of underlying assets just to give an example is the securitization of like a mortgage where you kind of take a kind of bad or subprime mortgage, which is not a good quality, and you securitize them and you transit, you put it like in the different layers, and then you kind of sell these layers, and some are there are sold as a very good quality papers, and then you know the underlying kind of like assets there can be a kind of like opaque in a sense, but it transforms these illiquid, you know, low risk assets by a number of, you know, inventive transformations to kind of something that is at least partly better quality than the underlying assets. But of course, there's this bad quality ones there also. So it's kind of tranching and layering them and kind of, you know, making this kind of financial innovation out of these. And then usually there's kind of the other feature here is that these type of shadow banking, you know, financial flows have very lengthy networks. They have like a number of different kind of players interacting together in a very kind of long and once again hard to track network. So. Again, this securitization is a good example where there can be like 7 and 8 different kind of organizations making these transformations, you know, repackaging, vouching for these assets, and therefore it's very kind of difficult to kind of then to verify what is kind of like what's happening in where. Then in many cases these shadow banks actually have a kind of implicit private sponsor support, and this was especially the case before the kind of financial crisis 2008. So these shadow banks, because they are outside the regulated industry and they have this kind of like non-guaranteed status, of course, then one could say, who would ever kind of deal with them? Why would you kind of like expose yourself to the risks that are there and are not insured and not regulated and everything? So in many cases, these shadow banks actually have a kind of background official bank or some kind of other, you know, private, like good quality player that has said that they will guarantee these kind of financial assets that are there. So a lot of, for example, these subprime market kind of securitization and special purpose vehicles and everything, had banks behind them or insurance companies or some other that kind of gave them credibility. But of course, you know, when then, you know, things started to fall apart, as it did in 2008, then this kind of private sponsor support turned out in some cases be not very kind of enforceable. However, there is a renewed kind of emphasis that these kind of private sponsor supports should be explicit and they should be kind of guaranteed. And this has led in some cases to the contraction of this kind of shadow banking assets, because not a lot of them have wanted to then endorse this, but there is this kind of like so they are not like separate from the official sector. They are kind of entities that have these connections, and that should be borne in mind. The problem is here is that they are kind of out of a balance sheet, over the counters type of things. And then there is different kind of accesses to these official backstops, which are kind of guarantees also. And there is a various kind of funding bases. For example, many of these money market funds, they actually use kind of like short-term funding to finance their operations beside the kind of like deposits. And this gives a kind of like increased risks, especially kind of like liquidity risk if something goes wrong and the short time, money, short-term funding dries up. So they will be in trouble, and there has been now, this kind of like regulation to kind of, for example, for banks to have a longer term funding horizons and everything. So this is something that are being kind of addressed at the moment. But these are the features, and as you can see from here, they are kind of like complicated, hard to follow, having a kind of lots of kind of transformations, repackaging, stuff like that, that makes it a bit problematic. Therefore, it's kind of surprising that the size of this shadow banking sector has increased a lot. And this is the Financial Stability Board's 2019 calculations of the size of the shadow banking sector in the world. And you can see that their estimate actually is that the size of the total global financial assets is a whopping almost $400 trillion. And if you look here, the central banks and normal banks and other public financial institutions, then, you know, there is this MUNFI, which is finance sector. It's kind of like narrow, you observed funding sector. Sorry about that. I can't now recall what is this MUNFI, but this actually means that it's about that shadow banking sector. And then there's these other like pension funds and insurance companies that usually haven't been calculated into this kind of like shadow banking sector. But as you can see, it's a huge and it's growing. And one thing that is very interesting, if we look at the shadow banking, where these kind of assets actually reside, and this is also from this Financial Security Board's, Financial Stability Board's review, is that actually most of them are actually in EU, which is kind of surprising that United States actually has only a quarter. And one of the biggest growth areas for shadow banking assets has been China. But still, if you look at the breakdown of these shadow banking assets across the different jurisdictions, then China is still like only 10%. This is kind of, I think, also interesting to note, because the Chinese financial sector, in comparison to their GDP, is really large. But these are the areas where they are, and of course the regulatory challenges here is that as one of the reasons for the birth of this type of entities has been this regulatory arbitrage. It's kind of apparent, and then the problem comes and as the kind of the regulators has acknowledged how to actually kind of like regulate this, how to kind of make certain that there is there's not the kind of possibility of losing the assets, and is the possibility somehow, especially for the households to secure them against like false marketing, false promises, and too excess risk taking. And one of the key things that the regulatory review of these challenges have highlighted is that there is this kind of a tail risk that is neglected in a lot of these pricing. When they price these products in a shadow banking sector, they don't take into account the possibility of these black swans, the kind of long tail, very seldomly occurring, but then high impact risks. And therefore, these products that are sold and transacted in the shadow banking sector kind of are mispriced. They are priced too low. And that is kind of a problem there. Then there is this, as I mentioned, this funding fragility, is that a lot of these shadow banks base their funding on short-term funding areas like money market, over-the-counter, over-the-night deposits and stuff like that. So there is this fragility that if something happens with liquidity in the economy, then they can't fund their kind of operations and they will collapse. Then the shadow banking sector entities also suffer from these leverage cycles, which means that when there is a kind of things going well in the economy, then the asset values go up and they can kind of take more, they can leverage their kind of assets to a higher degree. But then, if things turn out bad and there is a kind of like deleveraging cycle, which means that the value of assets go down and then the kind of the card board is kind of like collapses and these are kind of like exposed to this kind of systemic risks inherent in this kind of like leverage cycles. And then there's of course this agency problems, which is that do you really kind of like, do you have this moral hazard, adverse selection problems in the shadow banking sector? I would assume there is a lot of them. And as this kind of new shadow banking entities, some are quite new, there is not the kind of a prolonged understanding of how they behave and what kind of problems they give cause and kind of arise to. I think there is one element in this shadow banking that and banks as such that sometimes are left into the little bit of the sideline, but as I come from Vaasa, and there's this kind of like a strong emphasis on also from my work in Pellervo economic research, which is mutuals and cooperatives, I would also like to highlight these organizational forms. So in many cases, when we talk about banks, we talk about the shadow banks, we talk about financial innovation and fintech, we kind of forget the kind of the way these things have been built. What are they kind of joint stock? Are they mutuals? Are they cooperatives? And what kind of impact that has? And I just want to kind of highlight that there is these different ownership structures. In banking sector, there is, of course, the shareholder and then cooperatives and savings and government-owned banks. And now when we go then to fintech firms and stuff, these are kind of like different types of ownership structures, mainly shareholder-based, but one could also envisage a kind of cooperative based or some other kind of, you know, funding structures for these fintech firms. And financial innovation can also be about kind of like, you know, about the kind of way the ownership and incentives within the financial sector firms have been structured. And there's a lot of research done that there is these ownership structures also affect how the what is the behavior that we observe, and there is kind of like time horizon differences. There is kind of like different kind of emphasis on relationship banking. There's also different responses to crises, and there's also very much kind of evidence on the kind of like about the differences in profitability and stability. Juha Pekka can also kind of give his views as he has done stuff in cooperative with cooperative banks, but I think in a kind of main course, main kind of discussion, this aspect actually of financial innovation and shadow banking is kind of lost. That there would be interesting to see about these ownership structures and what their effect is. Well, we have about 10 minutes time, and I'm actually kind of, I'm on par, but is there, before we go, we're just going to start with the financial innovation, and then we're going to have a break. But do you have questions, comments, something to ask about this shadow banking sector or these ownership structures before we go to finance innovation? Can Juha Pekka kind of look, is there any questions?
Yeah, there's no questions in the chat, but if you want to ask something now directly from Olvek, just press the space bar in your laptop or computer. Still everyone is silent, so
okay. Well, I hope
write something to the chat if anything comes into your mind, so let's continue.
Yes, so this all we have come here now is actually the prelude to the second part of this four-part lecture, and now we are going to go a little bit out of the theory itself and more kind of like to the phenomena that are emerging at the moment. And therefore it's kind of like good to see what the financial innovation, what does it mean? What is kind of like the idea behind it, how it has been approached? And then, you know, what is these fintechs? Because that is something that is clearly kind of up on the air. There's a lot of buzz about it. And I give some examples of the Finnish context. But let's start with the definition. And this Peter Tufano actually defines financial innovation as an act of creating and popularizing new financial instruments, technologies, institutions, and markets. And as you can see, this is a very wide definition. We have been actually talking about almost all of these except the technologies now in you know, the last 245 minutes. We have been talking about the kind of the instruments, the markets, and institutions, but it's really a kind of all-encompassing idea of kind of like bringing a change into the way people and firms take care of their financial affairs. Well, we started the lecture with what innovation does. What are the kind of the functions delivered by financial sector? So then we can kind of go back and look, well, what does innovation do in this context? And as wouldn't come any surprise, those are the things that this financial sector functions try to accomplish. So the innovation makes them kind of more working more efficiently or bringing something new into it. So we can see that innovations exist to complete these incomplete markets. You learned that one of the reasons why we have banks and things like that is that there is this kind of like incompleteness. So innovation can come up with new products that you can kind of like base financial kind of contracts with different contingencies and stuff like that. And at the same time, this innovation is there to address these agency concerns and information asymmetries, how to kind of resolve this moral hazard, how to kind of take care of the adverse selection issues. And one part of the innovations try to kind of minimize these transaction search or marketing costs. You have websites for price comparisons. You have a kind of more easier kind of like and more transparent transactions. Then there is a kind of like one part of innovation actually tries to do this regulatory arbitrage. So you kind of have those things to kind of, unfortunately, perhaps to kind of avoid taxes, avoid regulation. And then there is this kind of like innovation that has to do with kind of globalization, like, you know, money transfers, you know, different risks in different kind of jurisdictions. And of course, one of the major that almost is synchronous to the fintech is these technological shocks, how to kind of technology digitalization, data economy can be kind of harnessed to kind of make financial sector more efficient. But before we go further, I would suggest that we have now a break. So this, I hope, just whets your appetite in a sense that that then we can start looking at why is this financial services sector now being under this kind of financial innovation, this disruption, and how it becomes about. So that would be then the kind of the second to 45 minutes. But what about you, Pekka, if we stop here for the pause and you get to kind of...
That is a good point to stop here. So are there any questions from anyone there? Now, no, still nothing.
Can I ask
all the questions to the end of the next session, probably. But
am I going too fast? Am I kind of, is there a problem that there's no questions that you can't kind of hear me or understand? Or that could be also a reason. So is it like?
No, I don't think so, because I can hear you quite well. I have no problems here, but if people are just sparing their questions to the end of the final session, I think so. So if there are no questions, you can obviously write the questions also to the chat always if you don't have anything to ask now. And you can also send email to Olli-Pekka afterwards if you have some questions.
Yeah.
But I think that we can stop this first session now. I have to start converting this one to the appropriate form of the film